UCCF's BeThinking website, BeThinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Right, today I'm talking about the first part of a two-part lecture with the title, I Know Christianity is True, But I Can't Believe It. I know Christianity is true, but I can't believe it. Today it's just the first part, and unfortunately today we can't have any discussion, but I hope we can have a long one after the next talk. The reason for this lecture and for this somewhat intriguing title is that exactly these words three students told me recently. And since they all independent said that to me, that they said, I know Christianity too, but I can't believe it, I thought, this is worth thinking about. This is worth exploring more. And I believe now that this statement summarizes, in a nutshell, very well, the struggle of a lot of the students who came here in these almost 5 years since I'm at the Manor. The more mature students among us should be surprised hearing that. Reading Francis Schaeffer and apologetic books around that time and hearing the stories of ages past gives the impression that people believed and lived out the Christian faith once they knew and accepted that it is true. This is not so in this generation. Somebody who understood and accepted the truth claims of Christianity intellectually can be far, far away of committing his or her life to it. The younger students, a lot of you will exactly know what I'm talking about. And I may reveal some of your personal struggles or questions without giving a good answer today. So today I'm more revealing the problem, and some of you might actually be quite raw after this talk. But I hope I can give some more answers and practical encouragement in the second part. But today, bear with me with the analysis of the problem. I also hope that you see the agony of the statement. None of the students said it lightheartedly or even with indifference. The statement, I know Christianity is true, but I can't believe it, reveals the ruptures, inconsistencies, and brokenness of this generation. I quote one of them. He said that he knows that he needs salvation, and he knows salvation is only found in Jesus Christ, yet I do not follow him. It was a very tragic moment when he said that, and we both knew it. Nothing flippant about it. So let's first look then on what does it mean, the statement, I know Christianity is true, but I can't believe it. Since it's not a question, but more an exclamation, we have to first try to define the meaning of it. Define the problem, as it were. And in a sense, this first lecture is all trying to get to grips with what they said. What do they mean by it? What are they actually trying to tell us, trying to tell me? What did they mean when they say it? What do you think they're referring to? What I think, in a nutshell, they are saying is that they believe and know that only Christianity explains the world out there and their own dilemmas, personal dilemmas, truly and adequately. But they feel that they are so insubstantial, so inconsistent, so broken, that they cannot hold that knowledge. It is not like pouring water into pots of clay. Some of you may remember in 2 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul speaks that we have this treasure, Christ, you know of, an earthly vessel, meaning our embodied soul. Right, so that's why it's like pouring it into a vessel. He said, it's cracked, but I can't hold it all. But this generation, it's more like pouring the living water through a sieve. Right? Nothing. They seem nothing is hold in it. And since most of them hate hypocrisy and they value authenticity, they feel they cannot say with integrity, I believe. In a sense, it's about responsibility. Responsibility from the word is means to be able to make response, making responsible choices, ultimately the ability to respond to God's call. Many of the people I spoke to, they actually were losing or have lost this basic human ability of responding. Also, and I think that's good about them, is that believing is rightly perceived as something more complete, more demanding than just knowing. Sort of knowing as in terms of cognitive understanding. We know it's more than just cognitive understanding, more than just head knowledge. Believing within the Christian understanding involves at least, firstly, the risk of being fully known as a God, and fully known as a person by God. And secondly, a personal commitment, ultimately, the commitment to the person Jesus Christ, to a God that comes so close that he wants to be called also our Father. A lot of our students do not feel able to such a commitment. As I said, this is a bit of a summary lecture, and therefore it is quite dense. I will give you 6 points what I am trying to illuminate the statement, but each short point could and should be explored in much more depth. And to help you with that, I will refer to some of our other material that deals with these issues much more adequately and in depth. So basically, I'm really building in this lecture and trying to summarize a lot of the teaching in the last 3 years. Let me just tell you the 6 points, what I think the expression, I know Christianity is true, but I can't believe it, what it may refer to. And as I say, they're not one point will capture it all, and they're not really separate points. They're all interrelated. Firstly, the statement reveals the discrepancy between the heart and the mind. Secondly, it might be the refusal of a generation who wants to have it all. Thirdly, it could be the cry of a materially spoiled and pampered generation. Fourthly, it is the cry of the perfectionist. And fifthly, it is also the cry of those who cannot trust anymore. And sixthly, and probably mainly, is that I think it is the cry of the introspective cynic. Right, this is sort of the advanced organizer. Let's just go through them point by point in a quite concise way. Firstly, it reveals the discrepancy between heart and mind. This a gap between what we know and understand in the Bible and the lived reality in our lives, how we feel about it, and what we do about it. This gap is usually created by fear and by distrust. What would it really mean for me personally to follow Christ closely, to really live out what I see in the Bible? And would Christ really help me with that? This raises different fears in all of us, and exposes our distrust, and we're all struggling with that. I want to recommend, if you're interested in that, my 2 lectures on psychological barriers to belief, to try to shed more light on this basic fears and distrust. But I realized over the last years that there's more to it than that's just this. Very closely related to the first one, it may also be, secondly, the refusal of a generation who wants to have it all. And if, since they want to have it all, they do not want to commit to any one thing, first on a practical level, but also theoretically. Firstly, obviously, when we all struggle with that, as a consequence, is, let's say, in marriage, saying yes to this one wife I have means I had to say no to all the others. And for us, I think, with so much choice and so much possibilities, it gets harder and harder to be willing to give up certain things, not to have it all. Especially in advertising, we think you can have it all. It's a lie. We can't have it all. We have to decide something to let go of. But this is not just practical, but even theoretical. I think many, I see another fear. People can say and acknowledge that Christianity is true, but we must not say that other religions or worldviews are not true. at least as far as the nature, for example, of the human problem and the way of salvation are concerned, that would be intolerant and presumptuous. For a lot of us, it feels immoral, it's close-minded, you can't do that. Even if it's true, almost, you don't have the right to say that. Therefore, I just want to refer to a very basic lecture that helps you sorting out issues in that way. It's by Dick Kuy's Pluralism, Relativism, and Tolerance. Very good introductory lecture. Thirdly, I know Christianity too, but I can't believe it. It may also refer to a materially spoiled and pampered generation. Most of us are not used anymore to labor for transformation and to wait in anticipation for the fulfillment of dreams and hope. But a lot of us in the West, growing up, a lot of the students I they have their whole lives lived already at the age of 20, bought by the money of their parents. Here's some examples. Had a luxury bedroom, a television in it, a VCR, a car, holidays in Spain and Greece, a mission trip in India, a term in La Brie, the museums in Rome, a language course in Paris, bungee jumping and a big bit of sex here and there on the weekends. What are they still hoping for? A lot of them have their life and all it can offer already with 20 at their fingertips without any effort of their own. And now, God, what about God? What about following Jesus in this real world? Now God does not come through to put the icing on their sweet lives. They have no idea what it means to follow Jesus. They are neither willing nor able to fight the good fight. And often, if you're materially spoiled, you haven't learned to fight. A lot of us, we only have learned to nag and to complain. Now I want to move to a bit less socially confined points, but a bit more personal one. Fourthly also, this statement might be the desperate cry of the perfectionist. Perfectionists can think like this: if I really believe that Christianity is true, I would be able to follow it. But since I'm not doing it perfectly, since I'm not doing it well enough, that must mean that I do not believe it, even though I know it is true. And the wrong underlying assumption is that if God is really there, he would change me so powerfully that I could not resist him. But since I'm still so inconsistent and since I'm struggling with so much, he cannot be there. He's certainly not in my life. And they realize over the time that the harder they try to believe in God, to make it happen, the less they're able to. Disillusioned and exhausted, a lot of them give up the internal striving. They give up the good fight. Therefore, perfectionism, leadership, Weber said, in this world, if you go for all or nothing, you always end up with nothing. Therefore, Richard Winter's tapes on perfectionism have helped many, and I can just recommend them if you think you're struggling in that area. Now, let me move to my last two points, which also are the most important points for this lecture. Fifthly, it is the cry of those who cannot trust that God is good. It is the cry of those who cannot trust that God is good. According to the values and moral standards of our culture, the Christian God is not perceived as good anymore. He is not occupying the higher moral ground any longer. Just give you a little example why that is. He's often rather perceived as a bully or egotistical, who by his sheer power tries to pressure people into worshipping him. Or he may be angry or a sadist because he puts those who do not like or agree with him into hell. What kind of God is that? Through many unanswered prayers, he may be perceived as a busy, absent father who is not concerned about the personal well-being of his children. And how can he be a God of love if he punishes people who love each other because it just happens to be a person of the same sex? This is what comes at us in our culture, these questions, very powerful questions, and Wade elaborates them much more deeply and helpfully in a lecture series that's called Are We Better Than God? However, These objections are rarely formulated intellectually, but they rather express themselves in a vague but strong emotional barrier and even dislike towards God. And surely, this God cannot be trusted with one's own life. To discern that, and to evaluate and own these subtle but massive obstacles, takes time and courage for our students, who are often not even aware of these negative emotions towards God. Because they think, oh, that's what they believe is all nice, but underneath, they just took in nagging questions from our culture. And don't have any answer for that. And so they build up this emotional resistance against God, this dislike. But in addition to these cultural influences, many students bear deep wounds from unloving, harsh, indifferent, even abusive family and church backgrounds, which make them shy away from deeply engaging in any kind of relationship, the personal Christian God included. Therefore, one question which is asked implicitly by most of our students is, can I trust you? And why should I? And how on earth could I trust the God I don't see? All the students who sent the statement to me, I was referring to in the beginning, they were coming from some sort of Christian background, which makes dealing with hurt and pain even more confusing, because bad and evil is done under the cloak of love and truth. It is so risky for them to go back and to dare to believe and commit again to that person, Jesus Christ, and consider church and prayer and whatever is involved again. The burnt child shuns the fire. The burnt child shuns the fire. This leads me to my last point, and as I said, they're very interconnected. That leads me to the introspective cynic. And this is not a separate point, as I say, but I see it rather, and I'll try to explain that to you, that to be an introspective cynic is a coping mechanism. It's the predominant response to the factors I mentioned before. Becoming cynical and becoming introspective seem to be the default coping strategy of many of this younger generation to deal with life. Just want to recommend Andrew Fellow's series on narcissism and his lecture on introspection, which highlight in much more depth the sociological and philosophical contributing factor that lead to introspection. And also we have a few lectures on cynicism, particularly recommend Wade's lecture on it. It just shows so well what it is all about, what the seeing through thing. Therefore, I don't want to spend much time giving all this theoretical background, so read up on it. But I personally want to focus on the practical consequences in relation to belief in Jesus Christ. First, let's do a bit of theoretical background. The masters of suspicion, or the so-called masters of suspicion, mainly Sigmund Freud and Friedrich Nietzsche, taught us to look a bit deeper into our souls, beyond our good deeds, beyond our friendly smile. Just look deeper. And they showed us that what we will find, most likely, beyond that, is selfish and dark. And we first apply this way of seeing to the world around us. Okay, let's not be distracted by the surface on the outside. Let's look deeper. To our parents we apply that, political leaders, our churches and church leaders. And we learn to see through the fakeness and unreality of the Western world. We find lies in the name of truth, control in the name of service, power in the name of love. And the conclusion of the cynic is that this is all you can expect. This is the truth about this world. And this gives you the right, or even the moral obligation, to detach yourself from this world, at least internally. But in the second step, so that's how you start, we have our own lives measured up by the same method, and we realize sooner than later that we are full of the same stuff. And that usually has two consequences. Firstly, we're ashamed of what we see inside of us. And in our shame, we hide from each other. The basic realization that I'm no better than the others. And secondly, in our search for authenticity and our striving to become a real and not a fake person, especially in our desire to become a good Christian, we start constantly questioning our motive. Look deeper, what's behind there? Just make sure it's okay. We are constantly second-guessing every decision we made, any word we have spoken, any deed we have supposedly done in love. And that is when we start to get caught into introspection. Many of our students live lonely lives inside their heads, inside their self-created hell of uncertainty, second-guessing, and self-deprecation. The noise of their racing, ever-changing thoughts inside makes every voice from the outside almost inaudible. As an example, you can have very sensitive people, very introspective people. They may go through the manor house and say a friendly hello to the person they actually don't really like. And they may hold a grudge against or just whatever. And then they realize that, oh, I said friendly hello, and it seemed nice, but actually my friendliness was fake. So now what do I do about it? Do I go and apologize because it wasn't a true and honest greeting? Do I have to then confess that I hold a grudge against them and we have to talk about that stuff? Maybe it was my mistake in the first place to hold a grudge to that person, and maybe it's just because I'm so critical that I don't like him or her. And so they just get caught up in this second guessing and this wondering what is the right thing to do. They can spend half a day and the energy on that, and it's just all-consuming. And then, after a while, their mind is in a complete knot, and they become paralyzed. But this is just rushing through. Let's just go very slowly now. Let's have a close look at the consequences. What does it mean to be introspective cynic? And I want to highlight that we are cut off from the world around us. That's the main thing. Through cynicism, we actively detach ourselves from the outside world. You look into the world from the outside, but you're not really participating. You're more a spectator. Even those people are a spectator to their own lives. And in our shame, we hide from the other person, and we spend most of our energy trying to solve our internal mess. And as a consequence, nobody is there anymore who could speak positively into our lives from the outside. We defend ourselves against positive, negative influences from the outside, only to find out that we are locked into our internal world, which is neither better nor more comforting than what's coming from the outside. So what does that mean now for our belief in the Judeo-Christian God? Firstly, we distrust God and other people, especially His followers. Secondly, because of our introspection, we cannot even deal with any person outside of us, but only with our mental picture of them. That's an important point. Not everyone may experience it that strongly, but I think we all struggle with that to a degree. For the introspective person, everything ultimately becomes only a construct of the mind. Listen to what a former student told me, and granted, she struggled with it a big way, but I think she highlights something a lot of people are struggling with now. So I quote, "God was a construct in my own mind. I did not believe in it because it was true, but believing in it made it true for me. You get glimpses of God and reality, but since they do not last very long, but you want desperately to live in it more constantly, you generate out of yourself an extension of these glimpses. You blow what little you have into divine dimensions. But this is not the real God, but just the construct of your mind. You can control and shape however you want. Realizing that God is an independent person to relate to was too terrifying for me." End of quote. Let me read it again. "God was a construct in my own mind. I did not believe in it because it was true, but believing in it made it true for me. You get glimpses of God in reality, but since they do not last very long, but you desperately want them to live more in it and more constantly in it, you generate out of yourself an extension of these glimpses. You blow what little you have into divine dimension. But this is not the real God, but just the construct of your mind. You can control and shape however you want. Realizing that God is an independent person to relate to was too terrifying. This tension is especially big for people who are struggling for whatever reason and in whatever way with their emotional life, who have big personal problems, but who for whatever reason are not able to acknowledge it, and therefore who try to fight these battles in their mind, and not where they should find it, where the problem is, on a relational level, on an emotional level. And often these are brilliant students, first class in theoretical argument and debate. But to present Christianity to them mainly as a worldview that is true as a theoretical system can increase their confusion. Listen to that student again. The problem of having all the right answers but no reality of it. Quote, I became involved in a gigantic confusion. On the theoretical, constructed worldview level, Christianity seems so true, good, and beautiful. One can see how it fits together and how it fits reality. And this is really what you want to believe. But on the more existential, relational level, I am afraid of God and fight against Him. End of quote. And then he concluded, quote, the lack of trust in a good God is the key. If I moved out of my own head, I was convinced that God would tear me apart and violate me. End of quote. If you want, this is still about a massive gap between mind and heart. The difference, though, is between the traditional understanding of that the main fear is not that following Jesus could be painful or embarrassing, but that actually that God's very existence as a person outside of them, a person that can't be controlled, can't be manipulated, is independent of them. This in itself is terrifying for them. And many of them became so confused that they do not know whether they are dealing with something outside of them or only the mental picture of it. That is really the difficulty. I want to give you an example now to show that not just extreme cases, but we all, or a lot of us, may struggle with that. I, for example, for years I realized, and I still probably have to watch it, have it in discussion about women's issue. You know, women's issue nowadays, especially in the Christian world and the church, can be done with, can be very heated discussions. And the personal, people get so involved and worked up, they have to be very careful how to lead the discussion, or better avoid it. And I realize as well, when certain people talk about women in leadership, or the role of women and men and those things, I just realized that it was just something inside moved me. And I realized that very often, I was just defending myself against that woman, against what I heard. But actually, I wasn't really listening to that person. But actually, I was defending myself against a certain picture I had of that person, what I thought she would mean or what she would say. So actually, I would defend myself, try to defend myself or deal with internalized women that influenced me, like my mother or sisters or previous relationship with women, or maybe my wife, or certain feminist thinkers or feminist theologians. So sometimes then when somebody gets up and we talk about these issues, then we hear all this in a very confused, messy way, all these former influences from whatever. It's sort of like sort of the mother, sister, feminist talking and influencing. Is actually that is what I'm hearing. And I forget to really say, leave all that behind and actually listen to what that woman is actually meaning and talking. And I think this is what we all do. I'm not dealing with her. I deal with an inner mental representation of her, of a woman talking about women's issues. And I think therefore it's very important for all of us to put in reality checks now and again. Is that really what she means? Can I really just listen to her? Is she really like my mom or like the family? Well, actually, no, she's not. She may have some aspects of it, but others are very different. I just want you to see and encourage you that whatever picture you have, especially of God, know about God and church and other people, maybe man or woman, to tell each other, to have a reality check. Is that really true? Let's try to listen again. So this brings me to the end of my lecture. And I want to make this point again about cynicism, which I think is so important, and the seeing through, and the confusion, and the loss that goes with it. And I want to quote the last page of C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man. It's just amazing that he predicted this development already 50 years ago. You listen again what he has to say. It's a different context, so it's not exactly about the context, but it's very, very applicable what he says. Quote, "But you cannot go on explaining away forever. You will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent, because the street or garden beyond it is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? It is no use trying to see through first principle." It's a defender of natural law and natural theology, that's why he called it first principle. But he said, it's no use to seeing through first principle. If you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But the wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. This was really true for many students who were brilliant students, of academic brilliance, but actually they couldn't see anything anymore. They had explained explanation away. They saw through everything and tried to see through everything. And in the end, especially themselves, they didn't see anything. They lost completely touch with who they were and what kind of world they were living in. And so they really lost this existential grasp of life. But saying again, if you cannot go on explaining away forever, you will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent, because the street or garden beyond it is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? It is no use trying to see through first principle. If you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. Let me repeat my 6 points again of what I think, what people are struggling with, what they mean. And I think they're not the three people, many people nowadays. People coming here to Le Brie, struggling with, I know Christianity is true, but I can't believe it. Let's have a look to the 6 point again. I think it reveals the discrepancy between heart and mind, maybe the refusal of a generation who wants to have it all. It is the cry of a materially spoiled and pampered generation. It's also the cry of the perfectionist and of those, fifthly, who cannot trust anymore that God is good. And lastly, it is the cry of the introspective cynic. So much for today. And in my second talk, I will try, and I hope to try, to give an answer to these struggles, to these problems. And hopefully also can provide with some practical encouragements. Thank you.